before the organisation meets its demise. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appeared, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack again. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osir Zam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union, most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with the starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Kalak organization, considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the MKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The MKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the MKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meir, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the MKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the MKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by NBC Radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA National Security Advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they received money. USA speakers received $25,000. French speakers received $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which is now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled, as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN Rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell, and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media, because the corporate media has been so locked out, because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them or their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So, unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
Pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his political refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by U.S. President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban, as they expect, because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinians to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayed Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. They lost the White House, control of the U.S. Senate, and failed to gain back control of the House of Representatives. But conservatives are parting like it's 2019. Donald Trump, no longer president, not yet a candidate, will be the headline speaker this weekend at the Conservative Political Action Conference meeting in Dallas, Texas. Also speaking will be his son, Donald Trump Jr., and a slew of Trump loyalists, including former Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Representative Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina, Representative Lauren Boebert of Colorado, and former Trump medical advisor Ronnie Jackson of Texas. The article you're about to hear has been written by Susan Milligan, who is a senior political writer at U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, CPAC Agenda Shows Trump Still Controls the Republican Party. Please stay with us for more of Susan Milligan's article. They lost the White House, control of the U.S. Senate, and failed to gain back control of the House of Representatives, but conservatives are partying like it's 2019. Donald Trump, no longer president and not yet a candidate, will be the headline speaker this weekend at the Conservative Political Action Conference meeting in Dallas, Texas. Also speaking will be his son, Donald Trump Jr., and a slew of Trump loyalists, including former Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Representative Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina, Representative Lauren Boebert of Colorado, and former Trump medical advisor Ronnie Jackson of Texas. Not scheduled to appear, conservatives like Senator Mitt Romney of Utah and Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, both of whom voted against Donald Trump during the 45th president's impeachment and Senate trial. Nor are there announced appearances for those who might be mulling a 2024 run, such as former Vice President Mike Pence or former Trump cabinet members Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley. It's an awkward situation for Republicans as the party seeks to reposition itself for 2022 and 2024. On paper, the GOP should be optimistic. Redistricting, retirements and historical trends suggest Republicans have an excellent chance of taking back control of the House of Representatives next year, and a real chance, too, to flip the 50-50 Senate. With political observers skeptical that the now popular but 78-year-old President Joe Biden will seek re-election in 2024, the next presidential campaign could be an open race, giving Republicans an advantage. But as long as Donald Trump, embattled legally but still very popular with a critical part of the GOP base, refuses to step aside, the future of the party and its hopeful leaders is in limbo. A lot of folks, in large part, are waiting to see what the former president does, says Matt Terrell, a partner at Firehouse Strategies and former consultant of the Republican Party in Florida. You can be a potential candidate out there running, but at the end of the day, they're waiting out there on the sidelines and waiting to see what the former president does. And with Trump, the wait out is a bit more complicated, according to experts. Trump's legal problems, his eponymous company is under criminal indictment in New York, could complicate a second run at the presidency. Further, Trump is known for his intolerance of those who cross him or challenge him, meaning would-be contenders have to make sure they don't make too many waves if they dip a toe into the political waters. Thank you. Former Trump cabinet member Nikki Haley, for example, criticized Donald Trump after the 6th of January insurrection and attack on the Capitol building, telling a Republican National Committee meeting that the president's actions would be judged harshly by history. 2 weeks ago, Nikki Haley was in First Caucus State, Iowa, delivering an address to the Republican Party of Iowa's Lincoln Dinner, a forum for would-be presidential contenders. But at that dinner, she praised Donald Trump and said she would not run if the former president decided to try to get his old job back. Mike Pence would seem to be the heir apparent if Donald Trump indeed announces he will step aside. The former vice president has been a consistent social conservative, popular with the religious right, and was a loyal and mostly quiet ally of Donald Trump when the two governed together. But Mike Pence angered Donald Trump, ultra-loyalist, when he rejected calls to refuse to participate in the certification of Joe Biden's win in Congress. Months after the Capitol rioters, some hauling a gallows, shouted "Hang Pence," the vice president was booed and called a traitor at the Faith and Freedom Coalition conference in Florida last month. He won't face that problem at CPAC, where Mike Pence is not scheduled to appear with his former running mate. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, a perennial CPAC favorite who typically gets the joint jumping with a passionate address, he's skipping the event in his home state this weekend, citing family obligations. Then there is Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump's former Secretary of State. He won't be at CPAC, but the Kansan is scheduled to be the headline speaker at the end of the month at the Silver Elephant Dinner, the South Carolina Republican Party's annual fundraiser and an important stop for candidates in this early primary state. Mike Pompeo is trying hard to straddle the line between setting himself up as Donald Trump's GOP successor without alienating Trump's base or even other more Trump-skeptic parts of the Republican Party. It's a unique position for people like Mike Pompeo to occupy the same lane as Donald Trump without appearing to share the same lane as Trump, says Nathaniel Burkhead, a political science professor at Kansas State University. The bench is small, it's very small, Nathaniel Burkhead says of the potential GOP field. And since Burkhead doesn't see Trumpism falling apart in the next 2 to 4 years, there isn't a lot of room for anyone who hasn't been consistently defensive and protective of Trump, he says. On the sidelines, but still very much in the public eye, is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Trump hasn't remarked on the public praise Joe Biden gave DeSantis, who similarly had kind words for the man who beat Trump in 2020, when the governor and sitting president huddled with Florida officials to address the deadly condominium collapse in Surfside, Florida. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis pleased a certain segment of the party when he refused to shut down Florida in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, citing the impact on the economy. He has since battled with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the cruise industry over whether vacation cruisers should have to show proof of vaccinations against COVID-19 before boarding. Ron DeSantis may have some issues in a national campaign because of questions about his handling of the pandemic, says Michael Binder, associated political science professor at University of North Florida. More importantly, the question is what will happen when Donald Trump turns on him, Binder says. Something like that's going to come, especially if Trump views this guy as potentially overtaking him. A CPAC straw poll held in February had Donald Trump in the lead, but Ron DeSantis led when the former president and fellow Florida resident was taken out of the running. Trump has been back to his old self, holding rallies, raising money, and suing people and companies across him, as he did recently with a lawsuit against Facebook and Twitter for suspending his account. But that can only take the former president so far, says Dave Woodward, a former Clemson University political scientist and GOP consultant in the Palmetto State. Donald Trump may be jumping around, but that does not necessarily amount to anything more than some raw political power, Woodward says. He still has his loyal group, but that's going to shrink and shrink and shrink, Woodward predicts. At CPAC this weekend, however, it's still the Donald Trump show.
Africa Today.
Thousands of Ethiopians took to the streets to protest what they described as interference by the United States. During the May rallies in the capital Addis Ababa, the protesters filled the city's old stadium and the surrounding streets in a well-organized, peaceful demonstration dubbed Voices of Freedom and Sovereignty. The protesters had a clear message to the U.S. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, my country, will proceed forward and won't go back. America should take its hands off us, and Egypt should refrain from the Nile Dam to show them that we Ethiopians will continue as a nation.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which brings you up-to-date analysis on African affairs. In our show today, we are focusing on Ethiopia's rejection of meddling by Western countries, especially the U.S., as it battles a rebel movement in the country's Tigray region. In the second segment of our program, we'll be talking about the recent parliamentary elections in Algeria as the country moves towards political stability. Now stay with us till the end of the show.
U.S. meddling in Ethiopia's Tigray. Ethiopia has been under increasing pressure from Western powers in connection with the situation in the country's Tigray region, where a rebel movement has taken up arms against the central government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered a ground and air military operation in Tigray in early November 2020 after accusing the region's then-governing party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, of orchestrating attacks on federal army camps, an allegation rejected by TPLF officials. The Prime Minister accused the TPLF of openly undermining his government.
Intent on perpetuating a culture of impunity and restoring the undue privilege they enjoyed in the past, the TPLF old guards have continuously mounted both covert and overt attempts to undermine the people of Ethiopia in our new administration.
The Ethiopian military, aided by Eritrean troops, has been battling forces loyal to the TPLF for nearly 8 months. According to some reports, Western countries, including the United States, are backing the TPLF rebels. The conflict has killed thousands of people and many more, triggering an immense humanitarian crisis. The United States has seen the conflict in Tigray as an opportunity to meddle in Ethiopia's internal affairs and has announced sanctions against this Horn of Africa nation. Ethiopians held a massive rally in the country's capital, Addis Ababa, to condemn U.S. interference in the country's internal affairs. Addressing the rally, Addis Ababa Mayor Adanech Abebe said Ethiopia will never kneel down to the U.S.
The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region risks heightening tensions surrounding the country's hydroelectric power project, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Negotiations over the dam with neighboring countries, Sudan and Egypt, have stalled and could be delayed further while the Ethiopian government responds to the ongoing crisis. Now, for more on the situation in Ethiopia, we have contacted Parama Alim, a senior Kenyan politician and an expert on Horn of Africa affairs. Thank you very much, Mr. Maalim, for your time.
Thank you.
Now, our first question. Ethiopians are protesting against U.S. interference in the country's ongoing Tigray conflict. What's the extent of this meddling, and what are the interests of Washington in this conflict?
Washington has a very powerful, very deep-rooted and old interest in Ethiopia and in the Horn of Africa in general, but in particular in Ethiopia, because for close to 30 years, the TPLF regime that controlled Ethiopia had worked as a surrogate, as a kind of the blue-eyed boys of the American foreign policy in Africa. And they were playing the role that Israel plays for America in the Middle East. They were playing it for the Horn of Africa. And so when you lose such a powerful ally who does all the business for you, it is costly, and they would want them back. But not because of the interest of Ethiopia or the interest of the continent, the wider continent, or the Horn of Africa. That is purely for American strategic interest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farah Mahalim, for that insight.
Eritrea's foreign minister has blamed the U.S. for the current conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region. Eritrea says U.S. administrations supported the Tigray People's Liberation Movement, or the TPLF, for over two decades. In a letter to the UN Security Council, Eritrean Foreign Minister Usman Saleh accused President Joe Biden's administration of stoking further conflict and destabilization through interference and intimidation in the region, apparently to resuscitate the remnants of the TPLF regime. As we have seen, Eritrea has also blamed the U.S. for destabilization in Ethiopia's Tigray region, what prompted the authorities in Asmara to issue the statement.
And the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which also controlled Ethiopia through the EPRDF, had waged a war against Eritrea. That was a very costly war in which they wanted to recapture Eritrea and exercise that hegemony. And that was also done with the tacit approval, the support, the financing, and all the elements of the Americans and the Western countries for that purpose. So Eritrea sees the meddling of the Horn of Africa by America and its Western allies, and has seen it from the beginning. It maintained its own independence, small as it may be. It is the only country that has stood firm and that has said a no, a big no, with a capital N, to that meddling. Right now, the Americans are trying to revive the TPLF again. You don't forget, Americans gave billions and billions of dollars in aid to TPLF, which is not accountable.
The TPLF led the coalition that ruled Ethiopia for nearly 30 years until Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed rose to power in 2018. He further alienated the TPLF by making peace with longtime foes Eritrea as soon as he took office. Abiy Ahmed won the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for his peacemaking efforts, which ended two decades of hostility with longtime enemy Eritrea. This is what he had to say on reconciliation with Eritrea.
I believed peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea was within reach. I was convinced that the imaginary wall separating our two countries for much too long needed to be torn down. And in its place, a bridge of friendship, collaboration, and goodwill has to be built to last for ages. That's how I approached the task of building peace, a peace bridge, with my partner, President Isaias Afwerki. We were both ready to allow peace to flourish and shine through.
Eritrea says that the U.S. wants to resuscitate the remnants of the TPLF regime which ruled Ethiopia for nearly 30 years. Now, does this imply that the U.S. is at odds with the current government of Abiy Ahmed?
The gains that were done by Abiy Ahmed has made massive strides and massive gains in the interest of the people of Horn of Africa in the wider sense, that includes Eritrea and Somalia, and also in the interest of the Ethiopian people themselves. I mean, that is not something that Americans would be happy with. Americans don't care what happens to the population of any country. You've seen what they did in Libya. You've seen what they've done in Iraq. You've seen what they've done in Syria. You've seen what they're doing right now using their own other machinery terrorist, what you call government, that they prop up in the Gulf States in the name of the Emirates and the Saudis to Yemen. So they don't care what happens to the 125 million Ethiopians. They only care about their own interests. And this bunch of a small minority that they have been using all this time to do the bidding for them. And it's precisely because of that that they want to bring them back. But they can't bring them back. Ethiopians are known to resist any form of domination.
Now, Western countries are accusing Ethiopia of using starvation as a weapon of war. Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Tai Atse Selassie Amdi, has categorically rejected these accusations.
When someone label us that we are using starvation as an instrument of weapon or war, it indeed pains us. It brings back a terrible memory of hunger. So, if, as I said in the council, if we did it, of course, we will definitely carry the albatross around our neck. The guilt will be on us.
The United States envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, recently issued a thinly veiled threat against Ethiopia by stating that it is time to move from analysis to action regarding Tigray. Now, Mr. Farah, the Biden administration recently appointed Jeffrey Feltman as the first U.S. special envoy to the Horn of Africa. Do you expect to see more meddling by the U.S. in this volatile and strategic region?
They will do a lot of meddling. They will create all the conflicts that they can create. American foreign policy in Africa and in other third world countries like the Middle East triumph or operate or escalate always violence and destruction of state and society, disintegration of state and society. And wherever they went, that's what they did. And they intend to do that also, but I don't think they're going to succeed this time. The African continent has come out of this thing wiser. And they know that the Americans are not interested in the African people themselves. They're only interested in the resources and the strategic position of these countries that are in the Horn of Africa. So they will continue meddling, but I don't think they can go far. They tried to meddle in the internal affairs of Eritrea for many years, for about 30 years now, and they lost. So Eritrea and Ethiopia now have also woken up to the realization, and they have a good leader in the name of Abiy Ahmed, who cares about his people, who cares about his continent, who cares about his wider region of Horn of Africa.
Thank you for that, Mr. Farah Mali.
The situation in Tigray has raised concern that the meddling by Western powers is meant to trigger the disintegration of Ethiopia, which is one of Africa's fastest growing economies. Some experts believe it could soon reach middle income status.
Now, our last question, are Western countries pursuing a policy to balkanize Ethiopia by backing the TPLF, which is pursuing a secessionist agenda?
They will pursue this secessionist idea to the extent of empowering them to take over again power at the center in Addis Ababa. I don't think the Americans really want to create small countries in Ethiopia. No. They want to use them right now as a secessionist movement, but the ultimate objective, the same way when the TPLF came to power, they came in as the Tigray People's Liberation Front and were agitating to secede from Ethiopia, but they never seceded from Ethiopia because they realized they had an opportunity right now to use the resources of that country and to basically brutalize it the way they brutalized it for all those years. And I think the Americans also want to use them to do the same again, roll back again into Addis Ababa, take over the reins of power using the tanks and the weapon and the resources and then all that given to them by America and its own other machinery surrogates like the leadership right now in Egypt.
Now, thank you very much, Mr. Farah Mali, Horn of Africa Affairs Expert, for your insight on the situation in Ethiopia. Now, we shall take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the recent parliamentary elections in Algeria. Stay with us.
Algeria moving towards stability.
Algeria's former ruling party, the FLN, won most seats in the June parliamentary elections. Now, the early election was supposed to exemplify President Abdelmadjid Tebboune's new Algeria with an emphasis on young candidates and those outside the political elite. Now, this is what the president had to say in February when he dissolved the previous parliament.
بتكون خالية من المال سواء كان فاسد أو غير فاسد تفتح أبوابها للشباب وقلت.
Following the June elections, Algeria's FLN, long the country's biggest political party, won the most seats in the parliamentary election. The FLN's 105 seats were far short of the 204 needed to secure a majority in the 407-seat parliament, with the Islamist MSP winning 64 seats. FLN's victory surprised many observers who had written off the party due to its links with former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Young people in Algeria have praised new electoral laws which presented them with opportunities.
The vote was held successfully despite a boycott by the long-running Hirak protest movement. Now, for more analysis on the recent elections in Algeria, we contacted Sami Hamdi, the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Thanks a lot, Mr. Hamdi, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, will the new parliament support President Abdelmadjid Tebboune's program as Algeria moves towards stability and progress?
The parliament and the role of these elections was to create some sort of legitimacy where legitimacy did not exist before. It was about filling this political vacuum that was left behind by the fall of Bouteflika and the absence of any renewed elected body. It's important to remember that the parliament before the elections was the parliament from the Bouteflika regime and not a parliament truly representative of the Hirak movement. Your question is that the parliament will go along with Tebboune.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamdi, for that insight.
Analysts say significant changes were made in the elections that cannot be underestimated, most notably the rise in civilian nominees amongst all the leading parties. The new changes include the Movement of Society for Peace bloc and the National Construction Movement, which will bring about some sort of balance in the political scene and in parliament. Algerians also had high hopes while going to the polls. An older voter expressed his optimistic outlook.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, in your opinion, will the parliamentary elections make a difference in the country?
I think it depends. I think it's important to stress that the regime is trying to steamroll the popular protest, not necessarily because it is entirely against the popular protest, but because there are certain fears and legitimate fears, if we're speaking objectively, that it has if these protests continue for an extended period of time. The first fear is that it gives rise to the separatist tendencies that the Algerian government is especially sensitive to. These separatist tendencies, the Amazigh, the Barbar, we've seen more of their flags being waved in the Hirak movement, and we've seen that the overwhelming boycott of the elections actually took place in those regions. There was whole region-wide boycott of the elections from the Amazigh regions, and the government fears that if the protests keep continuing, then France is going to support some sort of separatism, which it would be happy to do so in order to weaken Algeria.
Well, a very interesting angle there by Mr. Hamdi, that France might be interfering in Algeria's internal affairs by supporting protesters and others who boycotted the elections in the country. Algeria actually cancelled the accreditation of France 24 a day after the June parliamentary elections. The government said the move was due to the satellite news channel's clear and repeated hostility towards Algeria and its institutions.
The outlet said authorities had given the channel a final warning on March 13th over his coverage of Friday marches of the long-running Iraq anti-government protest movement. Ammar Belhima, the communications minister and government spokesperson, told the Algeria official news agency that France 24 failed to respect journalistic rules and ethics, saying it practices disinformation and manipulation in addition to confirmed hostility against Algeria. What will be the fate of the Iraq movement after the elections? Will it support Wayne?
I think the awkward thing about the Iraq is that the people who are participating in the Iraq have always boasted that their plus point or their positive point is they have no leadership, which has always baffled me and confused me, and it's one of the reasons why they've been unable to really translate their gains into tangible political gains that might actually be reflected in the parliament or even reflected in politics generally. But also it's important to talk realities in that the Iraq itself is badly divided, and that's primarily because it's easy to unite to bring down a regime such as the Bouteflika regime, because Bouteflika was the lightning rod. The reality is everybody has their own opinion. You have separatist tendencies, you have leftist tendencies, you have pro-Islam tendencies, you have nationalist tendencies that are unable to see eye to eye, and I think this is one of the reasons that the Iraq has been unable to essentially translate itself into some sort of political party that can actually dominate the parliament.
The recent parliamentary election in Algeria had one major difference from previous elections, and that was the much larger number of independents winning seats in parliament. Algerians voted for the independent candidates with high expectations. Now, these young Algerian voters believe the new parliamentarians will bring the much-needed change. Mr. Hamdi, our last question. Why have we seen an increase in the number of independents? Does this imply that voters have no trust in political parties?
It is the prevalent opinion, and people like this idea of I am independent, I am not associated with a party, I am not associated with a particular faction, I am not associated with a particular ideology, because the connotations and the implications are so strong in the Algerian subconscious. And this is why a lot of independents, while they ran as independents, they were aligned somewhat to different parties, but didn't say that openly because they were worried about how that would be received by the Algerian people. The reality is also that the political culture in Algeria, and indeed in the North African countries, is still not necessarily at a level whereby they can differentiate between the various different political parties. There's still this sensationalism whereby everybody is corrupt, everybody is bad, everybody's in it for their self-interest, whereas if you were to apply a more nuanced approach and actually look at the realities on the ground, I think there are very sincere individuals who actually engage with the political process in order to try to achieve something.
Thank you very much, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest. Now, unfortunately, our time is up for today. Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handle. Until next time, it's goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
At the peak of first and second waves last year, when Iran was one of the hardest hit countries in the region, it was the leader of the Islamic Revolution who stood like a rock behind the country's frontline health workers. He even declared those who fell in the line of duty as martyrs. We now present you an article written by Sayyed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger with over 10 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled, Iran's Leader Walks the Talk on Battle Against COVID-19. Please stay with us for more of Sayyed Zafar Mahdi's article. The cataclysmic COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc across the globe, bringing daily lives to a grinding halt in much of the world. In the words of United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres, it is the greatest challenge the world has faced since the Second World War. Some countries, though, have been hit harder than others, not because of incoherent or disorganized response, but due to external pressures from those seeking to weaponize the pandemic. In Iran, it has been a grueling fight under extremely challenging conditions. The country, battling cruel sanctions, with assets worth billions of dollars frozen abroad, has already overcome four deadly waves of the pandemic. And the battle continues, both against the pandemic and those weaponizing it. What is phenomenal, though, is how the Islamic Republic, notwithstanding heavy and seemingly insurmountable odds, has quite literally defeated the US maximum pressure campaign with maximum resistance and maximum resilience in a time of pandemic. This has been made possible by the visionary leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the torchbearer of the Islamic Revolution. The decision against importing US and UK-made vaccines and insistence on producing an indigenous vaccine was one of his masterstrokes, which not only illustrated his unflinching faith in local scientific talent, but marked a key step towards neutralizing the impact of sanctions and making the countries increasingly self-reliant. At the peak of the first and second waves last year, when Iran was one of the hardest hit countries in the region, it was the leader of the Islamic Revolution who stood like a rock behind the country's frontline health workers. He even declared those who fell in the line of duty as martyrs. When complaints were made about lack of adherence to health protocols in big cities, he appeared on television wearing a face mask and urged others to do the same. During the month of Muharram, he was seen sitting quietly in one corner of his otherwise jam-packed mosque, wearing a face mask and listening to the elegy reciters. These were incredibly inspiring efforts to promote the COVID-19 guidelines and undoubtedly saved scores of lives. When vaccines were rolled out in the West and almost all regional countries made beelines to have them, Iran's leader said no to the United States and UK-made vaccines. Some thought of it as irrational, while others knew that the move was properly calculated. This was not merely a rejection of foreign vaccines, it was a path-breaking move towards building self-sufficiency through domestic production, while encouraging local scientific talent and becoming a major vaccine hub in the region. Also, the untold and unheard of loud and clear, the killers cannot be your saviors. At that time, very few would have thought that Iran will come up with a homegrown vaccine in such a short span of time under the ominous specter of economic terrorism and maximum pressure campaign. It came up not with one, but four vaccines, with two of them already